Now we are delighted to present Angela Davis as our keynote speaker. Angela Davis is a renowned author and longtime activist in struggles for social justice. She is currently a professor of history of consciousness and feminist studies here at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and an active member in our community. Her work as an educator, both here in the U.S. and abroad, has always valued the importance of building communities across difference.
Recently, Angela Davis has devoted her time and energy to the prison abolition and critical resistance, a nonprofit organization. We are thrilled and deeply honored to have Angela Davis here today. Let's give a warm welcome to Angela Davis.
So good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. This is really a remarkable gathering, and I'd like to thank all of those who are responsible for organizing it. Can you hear me? Is the microphone okay? Okay, I'd like to thank Colleges 9 and 10 and Oaks College, Wendy Baxter. And I especially want to thank the student coordinators, Rachel Ogata and Valencia Herrera. Rachel came to my office just shortly after the fourth conference last year and asked me whether I would like to participate. And over the course of the year, we had so many conversations about this conference that I was thinking it might almost count as an independent study. But she told me that the overarching theme of this conference is providing dynamic learning experiences and tools to create local and global change. Provost Shapira, I am extremely impressed to see so many students here on such a beautiful Saturday afternoon. And I hope this means that you are as serious as the organizers about using the knowledge you have acquired and will continue to acquire here in order to help create better, more equitable worlds for all living species, not only human beings, but all living species from the world of this campus to the global world. Before I say anything else, I want those of us who are opposed to the war in Iraq. How many of us are opposed to the war in Iraq? Okay. So that's the overwhelming majority gathered here this afternoon, right? I want us to express our solidarity with all of the people across the country who are demonstrating at this very moment. As a matter of fact, a march started at 11 o'clock at the Civic Center in San Francisco and is going to Dolores Park. There are marches in New York, in Boston, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in Seattle, Los Angeles, and other cities. The marches have been called by the organization United for Peace and Justice. This is a national day of action in order to send the message one more time to Washington that the people of this country overwhelmingly oppose the war and want it to end right now, right now. And so they're calling for the troops to come home. They're calling for the private contractors, Blackwater et al., to come home, and for the billions of dollars that are funding death and torture and destruction to be used for education and healthcare and housing and, in general, to rebuild our communities. But of course, if we want to end this violence and other violences, if we want to end state violence, which will go a long way towards helping us rid our lives of other modes of violence. We need a great deal more activism. We need activism from the campus to Washington. Now, in preparing my remarks today, I started by reflecting on the meaning of the, oh, hi, of the name of the conference, Practical Activism. How might we define practical and how might we define activism? You know, practical can mean a lot of things. It can mean not impractical. It can mean not unrealistic, not unfeasible. It can mean sensible. It can mean useful. But in places like this, practical is usually defined in opposition to what? What would be the antonym? Theory. Yeah, somebody said theory. It's usually defined in opposition to theory. Now, I suppose that qualifier, practical, is needed because it is assumed that because we are here on a university campus, we are expected to work primarily with our minds. Is that right? I mean, I assume that most of you do a lot of mental labor, don't you? You may not think of it as labor, but that's what you're supposed to do here. And first of all, I'd like to say that we should not dismiss the importance of using our minds, especially at a time when not much of this is happening at the highest levels of government. But at the same time, we shouldn't assume that we are the elite because we are learning to think and learning to theorize. And we shouldn't assume that just because we are trained or are in the process of being trained as intellectuals, that there are not others in other places outside of the university who use their minds as well. And sometimes they use their minds much better than those of us who are trained to use our minds. Now, activism is a term that can be defined in many ways, but I want to use a very simple definition, and that involves putting the knowledge we acquire to good use so that it can make a difference, not only for ourselves as individuals, but for all of the worlds we inhabit. And actually, sometimes, in order to put this knowledge to good use, we might have to be a little impractical. We might have to be visionaries. And I thought that I might share with you a story about my learning how to think in a visionary manner, a learning how to think critically. I grew up in what was at that time the most segregated city in the southern part of the United States. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, at the height of Jim Crow segregation. And of course, as a child, I could not understand why we as black people were barred from so many places in the city. As a matter of fact, it's really interesting, even today when I go back, and I do go back pretty frequently, I realize that I only know about two neighborhoods in the entire city because black people were not allowed. As a matter of fact, I lived on the corner of, on the edge of a zone that was zoned for, a neighborhood that was zoned for black people, and we were not supposed to cross the street. It was illegal for black people to walk on the other side of the street. Now, I can remember being totally puzzled by all of this. Why? And my mother used to tell me that she used to say, this is not the way things are supposed to be. This might be our world now. You know, the world of racism and Ku Klux Klan and segregation, but this is not the way the world is supposed to be. And so I remember as a very young child learning how to think about what it might be like to live in a different world. And of course, this is before the civil rights movement. It's before the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. And eventually, many things did change. I'm not saying that things are as they should be today, but certainly that legalized racism can no longer be seen. So what I would like to emphasize for all of us here today is the importance of imagination in activism, the importance of using our imagination to evoke a different world, a better world, a more equitable world. There have been a lot of movements over the last, over the last century in this country, movements against racism, movements against war, movements against patriarchy, movements against homophobia, movements against apartheid. As a matter of fact, had not it been for this vast movement against the apartheid regime in South Africa, which of course was centered among people who were struggling for a new world for themselves, but there were solidarity movements all over the world, including on this campus. Without those movements, the apartheid regime would never have been dismantled. And of course, if I had time, I could tell you about how the movement to achieve my own freedom was organized. Some of you may not know, but I spent some time in jail. I was actually charged with 3 capital crimes. I was charged with murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy. And I faced the death penalty 3 times. I remember in a class that I was teaching, I mentioned something about being in jail as a student. You were in jail. You know, what are you doing teaching us? You know, because the criminals are the bad guys, right? Of course, this campaign was organized in the early 70s, at a time when someone named Richard Nixon was president, and at a time when someone named, what was his name? Who was the governor of California then? Yeah, that's his name. Ronald Reagan was governor. And, you know, despite the fact that I was innocent, there were people who looked at all of the forces arrayed against us and said, there's just nothing we can do. But there were others who believed in the power of organized masses of people and began to do the unglamorous work of organizing. And so committees were created all over the country. Students were involved. Workers were involved, labor unions, fraternities, sororities, churches, you name it. And eventually, this movement, interestingly enough, came into the courtroom because the attorney general, who had indicated that he wanted the death penalty 3 times, not once, you know, I mean, you can only be killed once, but, and by the way, it really wasn't about me. It was about using this to attack an entire movement. So I had no illusions that I was as powerful as they represented me as being, because I was just a representative of people who had joined anti-war movements against racism, movements for women's equality, et cetera. And so that movement came into the courtroom. The Attorney General ended up being placed on the defensive, and many of his strategies were based on the fact that we had argued in the streets that I was a political prisoner. So he had to try to convince the jury that I was not a political prisoner, but he didn't do a very good job of it. In any event, I was found not guilty, but it would not have happened had people not believed that an alternative to the vast power of the state was possible. Now, today you have a wonderful array of workshops to choose from, and I assume that many of you are attending the workshops, right? On campus activism, including the lack of an ethnic studies program on this campus. There's a workshop on racism and sexism in the media, on immigration rights. I just talked to Jose Palafox, who's here. The creation of what you might call Fortress America. There's a workshop on prison issues, prison expansion, and especially on the emerging movement in defense of transgender prisoners. Water privatization, and of course, this is not even the tip of the iceberg. And so what I would like to say this afternoon is that as we face all of these problems in our lives and in the world, from global war, the global prison, global torture, the juggernaut of privatization that is wreaking havoc on people everywhere in the world. This, by the way, is the meaning of global capitalism. The many manifestations of racism, both subtle and violent, attacks on our rights to education, and the denial of health care to increasing numbers of people. As we think about all of these problems, and you know they're talking about the possibility of privatizing the University of California. As we acknowledge all of these problems, what do we need? How can we spur ourselves to action? How can we persuade ourselves that alternatives are possible? First of all, we need some hope, right? How many of you are hopeful? Okay. I saw some huge patches of people over here who need to have a little hope. So maybe the hopeful among you will try to generate some hope among the hopeless. Perhaps what we need is community, solidarity, communities of struggle. We need to realize that change is indeed possible. So how do you know it's possible? Well, I would say that as horrendous as things may appear to be today, we live in a world that has been shaped by change, that has been shaped by people like yourselves who at other moments in history have believed that another world is possible. Now, there are still many problems, but we did manage to dismantle, you know, some of the structures of racism or sexism or violence. We did manage to create an awareness. And, you know, people often ask me, because, you know, the older I get, the more people think of me as representing a different era of history. You know, it's funny, even though I'm still here today, they think of me as actually living somewhere else in history. And, you know, oftentimes people come up to me who are my generation, and they say, I come from the 60s too, right? You know, as if they live back there. <You know? laughs> But in any event, those of us who came of age, as you are coming of age now, during that era, we really believed We passionately believed in the possibility of revolutionary change. And of course, there were revolutions happening all over the world at that time. There was the Cuban Revolution. There were African liberation struggles. There were people fighting in Asia. There was the Vietnam War. And the Vietnamese people were able to counter with practically nothing the enormous violence of the United States of America. So we did have hope. We could see with our own eyes that it was possible. But as much as we dedicated our lives to bringing about this change, the revolution didn't really come. You know, we thought the revolution was around the corner. It was going to happen tomorrow, right? And so often people ask me today whether or not I am disappointed that we didn't win the revolution then. And what I say is that I've actually learned a lot about what it means to struggle for radical social change. Perhaps we didn't win the revolution we thought we were going to win because many of us assume that we were going to dismantle capitalism, right? And that by now we would have been building a beautiful new socialist world. We didn't win that struggle, but we won a lot. We changed a lot. And if we had not fought as if it were possible at that time to completely revolutionize the world, the environment that is an environment you take for granted now would never have emerged. So you don't always win the victories you want to win, but in the process, you bring about amazing change. And, you know, I mentioned the 60s, and I really always warn against this kind of nostalgic memory of the 60s, which people often have who weren't even thought of in the 60s. You know, I mean, young people have come up to me and I wish I was born back then, right? You know, you had the Black Panther Party, you had, you know, the Brown Berets and the Young Lords and the American Indian Movement, and all of the amazing organizations in the Asian communities. But I was actually remembering that in the 60s, a lot of us had a kind of nostalgic attitude about the 30s. Yeah. Because what happened in the 30s? There were huge mobilizations. Where do you think unemployment insurance comes from? You take it for granted. You probably think it's always been around. But people struggled for social security, for unemployment insurance. They struggled against evictions. After the stock market crash in 1929, when things went downhill, there was perhaps some of the most amazing organizing in the history of this country. This was the period when the industrial unions were organized, when there were sit-down strikes, where there were hunger strikes, where millions of people marched to Sacramento and to Washington and in cities all across the country demanded some relief. But of course, when you read your history books, you read about the New Deal, right? And you think all of these ideas came from Washington, right? Rachel has just given me my 10-minute sign, and I'm hardly through my notes, so let me see if I can move on rather quickly. The point is that people have massively organized for change, and the world we live in is the result of those movements. It's important to look backward, but at the same time, we have to look forward. And I wanted to ask, I'm not going to have time to go through all of this, how it is possible. I mean, do you sometimes wonder how it is possible that someone like George Bush is the president of this country? I mean, do you sometimes wake up and think it must be a nightmare? You know, this is like not right. This is definitely not supposed to be. And a couple of weeks ago, one of the most eminent scientists in the world, you know James Watson, right? He got the Nobel Prize in 1962 because of the part he played in discovering DNA. Did you read about the comments he made in an interview he gave to the Sunday Times Magazine of London? He said that he had very little hope for progress on the continent of Africa. Why? Because, and I'm quoting, all our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence, speaking about Africans' intelligence, that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says, not really. I mean, can you imagine? This is a person who was in part responsible for the Human Genome Project. No wonder indigenous people all over the world are skeptical about providing DNA. And this was not the first time that James Watson had made such racist observations in public. About 7 years ago at a lecture on the Berkeley campus, he said, and I'm quoting from the San Francisco Chronicle article on him, he said that heavy black people have more sex drive than skinny white people. He also said that women should be able to abort homosexual fetuses. And then he has expressed the hope that eugenics can be used to cure stupidity or to make all girls pretty. Now, this is amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the most eminent scientists in the entire world. I mention this because it is assumed that at this point in history, we all react overwhelmingly with shock to such statements, with surprise, with astonishment. We ask, how is it possible? But in fact, we live with constantly with that racism, with the remnants of slavery, with the remnants of Jim Crow, with the violence of racism. And I wanted to use this example to talk about how important it is that we produce new understandings of the work that activism is supposed to accomplish. We should not allow our astonishment, this is the way we've been programmed to respond, to prevent us from understanding, for example, the nature of racism, or from understanding other forms of inequality and subjugation. Now, as you can see from James Watson, once you embrace the idea of a hierarchical humanity, some human beings are inherently more superior and others are inherently more inferior, there is no end to the production of hierarchies. And so therefore, when we get involved in specific activist campaigns, it's always important to keep this in mind. If you decide you're going to join the campaign for an ethnic studies program on this campus, these connections have to be understood. Otherwise, you might fall into the trap, as has happened on other campuses, into the trap of you know, marginalizing, say, gender studies within ethnic studies, or saying that gender studies really has nothing to do with ethnic studies, or assuming that sexuality doesn't belong in ethnic studies, or assuming that environmental justice has nothing to do with ethnic studies, or water issues, or privatization in general. Now, sometimes connections are very easy to grasp, but sometimes they are so obvious that we fail to see them. Sometimes we are so certain that the categories we use to perceive the world are unshakable that we fail to question them. And so today we are expected to define racial justice as colorblindness, right? I mean, we all assume that that's the way we're supposed to be. We're not supposed to notice racial difference. But then there's this mandate for diversity, right? So, and that tells us we are supposed to notice difference. So how do we deal with the fact that we're all supposed to be the same, but then we're all supposed to be different, and that difference is supposed to create, it's kind of crazy. And of course, if the discourse on color blindness tells us that we are not supposed to notice race, then how do we challenge racism? Because it also asks us, in many instances, not to notice racism. If you don't notice race, you're not aware of the overwhelming numbers of people of color behind bars. And of course, in the country, the majority of prisoners are black. In California, the majority are Latino. In the world, the majority are either people of color, which is the term we use in the US, or people from the global south. So if we do prison activism, our framework has to be global. The prison industrial complex, with its racist and masculinist structures, with its structural discrimination against transgender people, its reach is global. From its use to curb immigration all over the world to its use as places of torture to contain the people labeled as terrorists. And the figure of the terrorist is a racialized figure. If we ascribe to colorblindness, we fail to see the work that race or racism has done to produce this figure that terrifies us all, the terrorists. If we get involved with water politics and we struggle against the privatization of water, then our framework, it seems to me, has to take into account that we live in a world where capitalist privatization has gone mad. Water privatization is linked to the privatization of healthcare, privatization of education, privatization of prisons. It's now all about profit. And we're all encouraged to think about our own future as a future in which we will make lots of money, right? Right? I mean, it's okay to acknowledge that because that's a message we get everywhere. And that's what we have to deal with. Privatization has given rise to soaring prison populations around the world. And by the way, I really appreciated the poem by Fritz and the fact that he mentioned that there are over 2 million people in prison. But keep in mind that that number, because statistics can sometimes be mystifying, that number indicates how many people are in U.S. prisons on any given day, just on one day. Does not capture, you know, all the people who go in and get out, because people are being released every day and people are going every day. And I think it's something like 13 million people when you count all the people who go to jail and, you know, stay for a couple of months and leave. That's a huge number of people who are forced into this institution which generates profit and is racist and is in the process of being privatized. It's all about profit. I wanted to say a few words, but I'll just summarize this on Blackwater. You've been reading about Blackwater, right? Right? Right, yeah, and all the other ones. But I'm specifically mentioning Blackwater because, you know, Blackwater is one of those disaster capitalist companies that Naomi Klein writes about in her amazing books, Disaster Capitalism. And, you know about the problems you're having in Iraq now, right? But you may not know that they're planning to build a military-style training complex in Potrero, California, which is about 45 miles east of San Diego. I guess it must be where the fires have been raging. But they plan to turn a former chicken ranch into Blackwater West, with firing ranges, with a tactical driving track, with a helipad, with a 33,000 square foot urban simulation training area and armory for storing guns and ammunition and dorms and classrooms. And of course it will be located in the heart of one of the most active regions in the United States for border crossings from Mexico to the U.S. So, you know, watch out. The next thing you will be hearing about Blackwater is their attempt to participate in a privatized force preventing immigration into this country. So let me just conclude, because I think I've gone over my time. I have 1 minute, Rachel is telling me, so I think I can finish in 1 minute. And in this last minute, what I want to convey to you is that if you become involved as activists, don't think of your activist work as a charity work or as volunteerism. It's not about helping poor people who are worse off than we are. It's about building community. It's about building community across all of those divisions that are designed to keep us apart, across race, across class, across gender, across sexualities, across national borders. And it seems to me that the major goal of progressive and radical activism, as I see it at least, is to produce ever broader, ever wider human solidarities. It is to contest the individualism, the possessive individualism that causes us to see the individual as the basic unit of society. This is what capitalism teaches us. It is to contest the individualism that prevents us from developing strong emotional ties to people we don't necessarily know, to people on other continents, to people in Iraq, to people in the Sudan. The goal of radical activism, it seems to me, is to recognize that we can indeed change the world. Even if we do not accomplish all of the changes we want to accomplish, we can leave the imprint of our collective power on the world of this campus and on the global world. Thank you very much.